The State of the Union is strong, but does Justice Alito agree? Is the era of big government over? And is 1 year of Watergate enough? From WAMU 88.5 in Washington, I'm Ken Rudin, and this is The Political Junkie.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 13 of The Political Junkie. There's always been a huge anticipation for the president's State of the Union message, but how many times has it been consequential? How many do you remember? We'll talk about that with Paul Glastras, a former speechwriter for President Clinton. And in this week's podcast, we head south to talk about David Vitter's bid to become governor of Louisiana, and then we go west to talk about the latest incarnation of Jerry Brown. But first, the latest incarnation of the trivia question. Sunday's Super Bowl pits two teams west of the Mississippi River against each other. When was the last time a team from west of the Mississippi won the Super Bowl the same year as a president born west of the Mississippi was elected? You need to name the year, the team, and the president. Well, first you need to understand the question. But send your answer to Ken at KenRudinPolitics.com. We'll select the winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's Ken at KenRudinPolitics.com. Last week's trivia question was, we know about the president saying the State of the Union is strong, but who was the last president who gave a negative assessment of the State of the Union? The answer is Gerald Ford in 1975. You don't believe me?
The State of the Union is not good.
We'll talk about President Ford's address in a few minutes, but the randomly chosen winner is Jim Sparks of Battle Creek, Michigan. Jim gets that fabulous button. And that last scuttle button puzzle? One button read, Bush's tax plan, you're going to pay. Then there was one of the Tin Man from The Wizard of Oz. Then there was one of my favorite buttons, a green button with the letters I-N-G, ing, on it. That was for Alaska Senator Ernest Greening. Okay, so, you're going to pay, Tin Man and ing, add them up and you get pay Tin Man ing, who just so happens to be the quarterback of the Denver Broncos in Sunday's Super Bowl. And the winner is Melissa Fratkin of Austin, Texas. You can keep up with the latest scuttle button puzzles, trivia, and my weekly columns at KenRudinPolitics.com. On Tuesday evening, President Obama laid out his vision for year six of his presidency. He listed his accomplishments and he talked about his willingness to work with Congress to meet his goals, but he didn't shy away from going around lawmakers if he had to. So where does Tuesday's speech stack up against past presidents? And did Obama strike the notes he needed to? Paul Glastras is here to talk about this. He's the editor-in-chief of Washington Monthly magazine and a former speechwriter for President Bill Clinton. Paul, thanks for coming by.
Great to be here.
You heard President Obama's speech. Did he do what he needed to set out to do?
I think there's no question. I think it was rightly cast for the moment. We all know that he's constrained by an opposition party that has been unwilling to advance his legislative agenda. He continued to push on some of that, but also offered alternative ways that he could move the country forward. It was a thematic speech, a little bit more thematic than perhaps we've seen, almost all of it under the heading opportunity. All the policy pieces fit into that. And it had a kind of light touch. It wasn't like last year as triumphant and aggressive against the Republicans as it might have been. And it was uplifting and had some great real people in the audience.
It's also a much different President Obama in January 2014 than it was in January 2013.
Well, no question. Last year, right, he had just won this historic victory and rightly came in hoping that that would allow him to perhaps move some big pieces of legislation. I think it was predictable that it would not, but they thought, why not give it a try? This year, they know that that's not going to happen, and they're trying to set expectations for what he can get done rightly.
Did you see it as a partisan speech? You know, in some parts of the speech, President Obama was talking about how he appreciated that Congress would give him a budget deal, things like that. But other times he seemed to be willing to, like, mock the Republicans. Okay, we know that you want to repeal Obamacare. It's not going to happen. Enough already.
I'd say it's a mixed bag. In any one of these speeches, the president has the upper hand. He's the one speaking. He's the one setting the agenda. I'd say he tweaked them a few times. And he sent a lot of messages to his base voters, which may have made it seem partisan. But as I said, I think he was less aggressive against Republicans than a lot of people were expecting. He used language that allowed Republicans, if they so choose, to join in. I thought his line about Speaker Boehner having grown up as the son of a barkeep, and he understands opportunity as the president, the son of a single mother, does, was a moment of, we're all in this together. We all know what the American dream is together. So there
was, and he got one of those rare standing ovations from both sides of the aisle.
That's right. That's right. And so, you know, these things always have a partisan tinge, and I think rightly so. This is a battle over ideas, a battle over policies. But I wouldn't say this was the most partisan I've seen.
Did you get the sense that he came into the speech on Tuesday with lesser expectations than usual? You know, in the past, he's talked about these grandiose things about healthcare and perhaps limiting guns. It seemed almost like he played small ball.
Well, you know, he accomplished major pieces of legislation in the first term. Healthcare reform, nearly $1 trillion stimulus, successful bailouts of Detroit. So he came into his second term hoping to keep that kind of a record going. It was clear, I think, for a lot of people that wasn't going to happen, but he gave it a try. Now he, as I said, he's recast in a more realistic way what he can get done. And I think, you know, I worked for President Clinton in the second term where we were not going to get a lot of big legislative accomplishments. With Republican Congress. But we got lots of small steps. We expanded Medicaid. We created the Children's Health Program. We wound up continuing to pay down the debt. Lots of things that moved the country forward. In the 1998, President Clinton came out and called for a massive increase in the federal government's efforts on education, saying that federal government would hold school districts and schools accountable that failed low-income kids. He didn't pass that piece of legislation in 1999 or 2000, but he started the discussion. George Bush came along, passed No Child Left Behind. Then after that, we got the Common Core Standards, and right before that, Race to the Top. So what President Clinton started as a quote-unquote lame duck in the 99 State of the Union wound up paving the way for some, you know, very major change in federal policy.
Perhaps President Obama is a lame duck. Of course, he can't run for a third term. And perhaps he will not get any kind of cooperation from the Congress, or at least not the House. He has an ability. He has the right to go around Congress.
No question. And every president who's smart will use every lever of power at his disposal. When Bill Clinton in 96 faced off with Republicans who wanted to dig for coal in the sandstone wilderness of Utah, he uses executive power under the Antiquities Act to create what is effectively the largest national park in the country, the Escalante Wilderness. It was one that was deeply resented, this move, by the Republican Party. But now you have some booming tourist towns out there. A beautiful wilderness has been saved. He did it unilaterally. There's a lot of fairly substantial things presidents can do unilaterally. Probably the greatest example, Harry Truman couldn't get desegregation legislation passed Congress. He unilaterally, under executive order, desegregated the U.S. military. That was the first step to the civil rights movement in some ways, or certainly the federal role in it.
You worked with Bill Clinton on the State of the Union addresses and other speeches. What goes into preparing for a State of the Union address?
So the State of the Union address is an action-forcing event. Because this is the one day of the year where the president knows he's going to have an hour's worth of time to speak to the American people, tens of millions of them, unfiltered by you and me and the media, the whole apparatus of government, the entire executive branch, the president's party in Congress, the interest groups, lobbyists, all go to work for, you know, months ahead to try to get on the agenda, to try to be mentioned in the State of the Union address. That sorting and effort to build an agenda then gets translated by the speechwriters into a speech that becomes the litigated language in the agenda for the whole rest of the year. So it started out as a kind of throwaway line in the Constitution, but it's become the organizing principle of the annual presidential agenda.
When I think of President Clinton's State of the Union address, I always think of the one, I guess, in 1996, where he talked about the era of big government is over. Let me play a little clip from that speech.
We know and we have worked to give the American people a smaller, less bureaucratic government in Washington. And we have to give the American people one that lives within its means. The era of big government is over.
That's not something you usually hear from a Democrat. At that time, did you feel that that line was significant?
So I wasn't in the White House at that time, but my boss, Michael Waldman, was there and helped write the speech. And it's a funny thing. No one in the Clinton White House intended for that line to mean what we now think it means, which is, I'm giving up on big government liberalism. That was a line that was supposed to be paired with, and the age of every man for himself must never begin. And no one in the White House complained about the era of big government is over. They complained about the hymn. They thought it was sexist. So they said, well, they should not. And they kept torturing the language to where you didn't even play what came afterwards, but it was some pablum. And because it was pablum that came after that, and because people rightly thought, well, you know, the Clinton administration is battling a conservative ascendancy in Congress, that it had greater meaning than the Clinton administration ever intended it to have.
You worked with President Clinton on subsequent addresses. Was there any one line, anything you're so personally proud of that, like, wow, I did this, I wrote this, and he said it?
Under the lore of speechwriters, you're not supposed to brag about the line you wrote.
Yeah, but on The Political Junkie, I brag all the time. So, you're allowed to do that.
Well, I'll brag about the line my brother wrote. So in 1999, I was at home in St. Louis, hanging out with my brother, George, in the basement of my parents' house and working on the speech. And I told him that I needed a line to convey the idea that was in the speech of giving reports to the American people on the quality of their schools. And my brother came back and said, it's easier to get information about the quality of local restaurants than the quality of local schools. I said, bingo, I'll put it in the speech. And it survived. So you often have to squint at a final draft of a State of the Union to see your original wording. But that one more or less stayed intact.
Listening to Bill Clinton reminds me there have not been that many memorable lines from past State of the Union messages, but I assembled a few of them here, and I want to get your reaction to some of them. There was that line that President Obama gave in 2010 about the Supreme Court's decision in the Citizens United case.
The Supreme Court reversed a century of law that I believe will open the floodgates for special interests, including foreign corporations, to spend without limit in our elections.
Now, saying that in itself was not especially significant, but of course everybody remembers that members of the Supreme Court were sitting right in front of President Obama, and Justice Alito was, shaking his head, mouthing the words, not true.
Not true, that's right.
That's pretty remarkable.
And that was the same period of time when a congressman, I don't think it's the same year, but a congressman, I think it was Joe Wilson of South Carolina, responded, mouthed the words, "You lie."
He said it more than mouthed it. He said it out loud.
And
right.
That's right. So I didn't see anything quite like that. I think, I think that the old rules have reimposed themselves.
Well, of course, Justice Alito wasn't there Tuesday night. He was perhaps watching at home. Speaking of another memorable moment, there was George W. Bush in 2002 talking about the axis of evil.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world.
That was pretty big stuff.
Very big stuff. It was inaccurate stuff, however. The story behind that line is that the chief speechwriter was given a memo, kind of dashed off, comparing Iraq, Iran, and North Korea to Japan, Germany, and Italy. Well, Japan, Germany, and Italy were an alliance. Iraq and Iran hated each other, and there was almost no connection to North Korea. And so there was a sort of a fundamental historical inaccuracy that led to a mistake in the policy.
President Reagan was all set to give his State of the Union address on January 28, 1986, but that morning the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded shortly after liftoff. 7 astronauts were killed. Reagan commemorated their lives when he finally did give the address.
Thank you for allowing me to delay my address until this evening. We pause together to mourn and honor the valor of our 7 Challenger heroes, and I hope that we're now ready to do what they would want us to do. Go forward, America, and reach for the stars.
There was really nobody like President Reagan who could reach out to the American people.
He was magnificent. One of the dirty secrets of the Clinton administration is how often we reread Reagan's speeches and patterned structure and effect after what he did. They were often very, very effective.
Earlier in the show, we alluded to President Gerald Ford's assertion in 1975 that the State of the Union was not good. Let me play an extended version of what he said.
And I must say to you that the State of the Union is not good. Millions of Americans are out of work. Recession and inflation are eroding the money of millions more. Prices are too high and sales are too slow. This year's federal deficit will be about $30 billion. Next year's probably $45 billion. The national debt will rise to over $500 billion.
Boy, that's an encouraging bit of news.
Yeah, you can see the roots of the argument that presidents should always be optimists. What a downer, what a buzzkill. But, you know, it's incumbent upon the president to give the country some sense that they've got a grip on the problem. There's nothing wrong with being honest about the nature of the problem or the extent of the problem. And I suppose elsewhere in the speech, it's more of that sense of command and leading the march out. But that was something I don't expect other presidents will follow.
Ford, of course, became president in August of 1974, succeeding Richard Nixon, who resigned. For his part, Nixon, in a speech that turned out to be his last State of the Union message in January, he declared that America was tiring of all these Watergate investigations.
I believe the time has come to bring that investigation and the other investigations of this matter to an end. 1 year of Watergate is enough.
Little do we know that he would be gone from office not too long afterwards.
You know, the funny thing is, he probably spoke for a lot of Americans when he said that, right?
Enough.
They probably had enough, and it's certainly his side wanted to hear that.
I want to play excerpts from two more State of the Union messages. The first one is from Lyndon Johnson in 1964 when he declared an unconditional war on poverty.
And this administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America.
Boy, talk about the era of big government being over. This was big government.
I hear that and I think two things. One, that speech probably was the one that can be said to have led to more big programs that actually got done than any other State of the Union address ever given. On the other hand, that framing, the war on poverty, I think, has haunted Democrats ever since. How often have you heard, you know, they declared war on poverty and poverty won? It's not quite true, but subsequent presidents who declared war on illiteracy and war on drugs, they've come to rue that framing.
It also pays to have both houses of Congress solidly as part of your party, which Lyndon Johnson had.
Absolutely. No president has really had that since.
One final piece of tape. This is 1941, Franklin D. Roosevelt in his famous address talking about the four freedoms.
First is freedom of speech and expression. Everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way, everywhere in the world. The third is freedom from want, which translated into world terms means economic understandings which will secure to every nation a healthy, peacetime life for its inhabitants everywhere in the world. The fourth is freedom from fear, which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction of armaments to such a point and in such a thorough fashion that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor anywhere in the world.
That was 1941. I could hear a president saying that today.
You know, whole books have been written on that passage. Next to the Gettysburg Address and a few other presidential utterances, world historic in its implications. It was not only an internationally focused speech, but one that reimagined what freedom is and added to the negative freedoms that the founders understood, freedom from things, the positive freedoms that is more in line with the liberal agenda, the freedom of from want, but obviously the freedom to be secure, the freedom to have enough food, the freedom to have shelter. He was very crafty and did it very consciously. And the story is that this came in the fourth draft of the speech, and he leaned back in his chair, paused for an uncomfortably long moment, and then dictated more or less word for word to his speechwriters very slowly exactly what you heard.
There's not many State of the Union addresses that stand out in time, but what I appreciate you doing, Paul, is that there's a backstory to all of these, and the fact that you were part of that history is really, really very special, and thank you for coming here and doing this for us.
It's my great pleasure.
Paul Glastris is the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly magazine and a former speechwriter for President Bill Clinton. He can be found on Twitter at Glastris, G-L-A-S-T-R-I-S. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Coming up next, Louisiana Senator David Vitter wants to be Louisiana's next governor. And remember Jerry Brown? He's turned around California's economy and, at age 75, doesn't look like he's slowing down a bit. Stay with us. It's time for This Day in Political History. Today, the questions are about Benghazi and the IRS and NSA spying, what the government knew and when it knew it. Decades earlier, the subject was Watergate, the June 1972 break-in at the offices of the Democratic National Committee, the cover-up which led all the way up to President Nixon himself. On this day in 1973, two former officials of the Committee to Re-elect the President, G. Gordon Liddy and James McCord, were found guilty of conspiracy, burglary, and the wiretapping of the DNC. The next day, Senator Sam Ervin of North Carolina announced he would convene a five-member committee which would have subpoena power to investigate the break-in. Less than 4 months later, McCord appeared before that Senate Watergate committee.
My participation in the Watergate operation, on my part, for whatever reasons I may have had at the time, whatever rationale I may have had at the time, was an error, was a mistake, and a very grave mistake, which I regret.
It was on this day in 1973 that McCord and Gordon Liddy would be found guilty for crimes committed during Watergate. The dominoes, of course, had only begun. President Nixon would resign his office 18 months later.
Well, there was Haldeman and Gray and Mitchell and Dean. A whole lot of folks were shaking on the White House scene. They patched up the cracks, but the dam broke loose. Watergate was all you could read in the news. And Dickie said,
there's nothing quite as interesting as Louisiana politics. The Pelican State has a history of colorful characters and scandals. Just look at today's headlines. Ray Nagin, the former mayor of New Orleans, is on trial for corruption charges. Edwin Edwards, the 86-year-old former governor and lifelong rascal, may be considering a run for Congress. And Senator Mary Landrieu faces the fight of her life in her fourth-term bid. The big news of recent days, though, is the announcement that the state's other senator, Republican David Vitter, wants to be governor. John McGinnis is a longtime analyst of state politics and publisher of LawPolitics.com. John, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Hey, thank you, Ken.
John, we could spend an entire show just talking about Louisiana politics, and I think someday we just might.
Well, I've spent a career. So
it's a rewarding and rich career. Let's stick to the Vitter announcement for now, though. Nationally, people know of him because of his involvement in the prostitution scandal, but Louisiana voters had the chance to judge him during his 2010 re-election campaign, and he won in a landslide.
Yeah, you know, I often say, judging that we the state elected Evan Edwards four times, that it takes more than one sex scandal to bring down a Louisiana politician. Vitter easily, of course, he really wasn't, the scandal wasn't brought up by his Democratic opponent, but not that people didn't know about it. They gave him a pass.
And he seemed to, I mean, he won convincingly. There seems to be a sense of forgiveness.
Well, also, you have to remember the 2010 election was as much against the Democrats as it was anything else. And Vitter managed to Obamacize his opponent, former Congressman Charlie Malosaw, and the mood of the electorate was pretty anti-Democrat at the time, and so people weren't focused as much on a sex scandal that was 3 years old then.
Vitter, as you say, has been a strong and leading critic of President Obama, and the president's numbers have always been poor in Louisiana. Does that play in the gubernatorial race?
Yeah, I'm sure it will. It's played in helping rebuild his image. Down here, voters in Louisiana, when they see him, you know, taking on the president, or even in the case with his effort to make the rules of the Affordable Care Act apply to members of Congress and their staffs, that may have been very unpopular in Washington, but it was real popular down here. He knows how to go after a red meat issue and really stir up the conservative voter down here.
In addition to what he's saying about President Obama and Obamacare, things like that, what else is Vitter talking about?
Well, one thing he doesn't talk about so much, but he has a reputation for being very competent and efficient, and that plays well down here. He knows how to get things done, and, you know, he's had a reputation in the past of being a real bomb thrower, but now he's trying to, I think, get across the idea that he's a competent official and, you know, what Louisiana will need.
He's taken on his own party in the past as well, but the party seems to have rallied behind him. Does he have Republican opposition in the bid for governor?
Yeah, there will be some. Lieutenant Governor Jay Darden is very popular, perhaps more moderate than Vitter is, but he's been a long-time state official, and he's popular around the state. And in Louisiana, of course, we have what's called nationally the jungle primary, a nonpartisan open primary. Everybody runs regardless of party.
Right, everybody's on the same ballot.
So if it came out to where he was, if the Democrats, who haven't done very well in recent elections, if they fail to get a candidate in a runoff, and if David Vitter is in a runoff with another Republican like the Lieutenant Governor Jay Darden, he could have a real trouble, because in that case the Democrats would be the swing voters, and they'd be voting for the one who scares them the least. And right now, David Vitter scares a lot of Democrats.
You're talking about Democrats, and we're talking about President Obama's unpopularity. What does that mean for people like Senator Landrieu?
She's in a tough situation. If the election is really focused on national issues like Obamacare the way it is right now, I think she's going to have real trouble in November. Maybe, though, it didn't turn out to be that great of a issue against the president in 2012. It may not, end up being that great an issue at the top of voters' minds in the fall of this year. Landrieu does have a good reputation for really standing up for Louisiana, for, doing a good job on bringing projects home. She's been a stout defender of and supporter of the oil and gas industry, to the chagrin of many Democrats in Washington, and the notion that the possibility that she would be the next Energy Committee chairman works in her favor. Maybe not every voter cares about that, but I think she might be able to make the case that, look, it's important to the energy industry in Louisiana for me to be the chairman of that committee than for some more liberal Democrat.
Vitter is hoping to succeed Bobby Jindal, who's barred from seeking a third term. What kind of a governor has Jindal been? How are his numbers? You know, he was once talked about being a presidential prospect, but nobody seems to be talking about that anymore.
No, and he's had a rough time in the last 4 or 5 years. His stout refusal to raise taxes in any way has not played well with the at a time when the state finances have been in such trouble after the national recession, and it's forced him to make big cuts in higher education and in hospitals. And those things, after a while, really wore thin on the people in the state. Even conservatives in the state, they want to see that, those things taken care of, the safety net hospitals and the colleges. Jindal is just trying to recover from that right now, holding on to his tax virginity, has cost him with popularity among voters. That and his incessant travel out of state, in some ways people thought that was nice to be able to have a governor who could go places and not bring shame on the state. But in another way, he was seen as being absent so much that began to wear thin on people. And now that he's not seen as really much of a presidential candidate, people wonder, well, what was all that for?
Well, I'm wondering about that. I mean, obviously you can't raise taxes as governor and then hope to appeal to a Republican electorate in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina.
Well, in one way, but I mean, there's some things he could have done. People think Louisiana has one of the lowest tobacco taxes in the country and one of the unhealthiest populations, and he probably could have got away with doing that if the money was dedicated to health care or higher education. But so he was seen in many ways as putting his ambition and his ideology ahead of what's best for Louisiana.
I know we have a long way to go before the election, but is David Vitter going to be the next governor?
I wouldn't go so far as saying that. We haven't seen the whole field, and we really haven't seen who the real Democrat will be that could challenge him. Mary Landrieu's brother, Mitch Landrieu, is up for a re-election this Saturday as mayor of New Orleans, and it's expected he's going to win. He has some opposition, but he's seen as being probably the strongest Democrat right now in the state, and he could be a forceful competitor to David Vitter. We have a state legislator who's running, and there could be some other names come up. Boy, there's 20 months to go before that election. I'm expecting some unexpected things are going to happen.
That's typical of Louisiana politics.
Let's hope.
John McGinnis publishes lawpolitics.com. He can be found on Twitter at lawpoliticsnow. Thanks for being on the program, John.
Hey, thank you, Ken.
For the longest time, California was thought to be ungovernable. Spiraling deficits, a constitutional roadblock to raising taxes, failure in its leaders to manage their finances. And it was bipartisan failure. Gray Davis, a Democrat, was booted out in a recall campaign. Arnold Schwarzenegger, a Republican, left office with dreadful polling numbers. So where's the Golden State now under Governor Jerry Brown? Steve Swann is a longtime California political journalist and analyst in Sacramento. Steve, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Just a few years ago, California had the lowest bond rating of any state government in the country, with a deficit of $4 billion and no sign of turning things around. Now it actually has a big surplus. How did that happen?
Well, there were a number of factors. First of all, Governor Brown did bring with him a great deal of experience from his first 8 years as governor back in the 1970s and early 1980s, and I think that helped a lot. He did have a gradual recovery in the state of California, but the governor also used the bully pulpit as governor to go around the state and convince Californians to vote for Proposition 30, which was on the ballot, and it increased sales tax very moderately, but it also increased taxes on the wealthy, and that helped with an infusion of dollars so that now, according to the latest estimates, we have about a $3.2 billion surplus. And when he started after the election in 2010, we had about a $25 to $26 billion deficit.
So, I mean, aside from having super majorities in both the Assembly and the State Senate, Governor Jerry Brown perhaps deserves much of this credit.
I believe he does. Yes, there are supermajorities in both houses of the legislature, but you have to remember that many of the Democrats in the Senate and the Assembly want to spend more money on health and welfare programs, on other social programs, on education and things like that. And the governor is quite moderate. He's holding the reins. He's keeping spending down. He has established a reserve for economic uncertainties, or a rainy day fund. And he is saying no to spending on new programs, realizing that what could be a boom today could end up to be a bust tomorrow.
You and I were on Beth Ruyak's Insight show last week on Capital Public Radio, and we were both listening to Brown's State of the State address. Of course, back in the day, he was seen as kind of flaky. We always, you know, talk about the Governor Moonbeam, but that seems like a million years ago. But I think you're right. I agree with you. Listening to him talk about the surplus and the need for rainy day funds and the warning to his members of his own party that we can't go on a spending spree, he seemed almost like an adult.
Well, as a matter of fact, the leading Republican in the Assembly has called him the only adult in the room, and that's quite an accomplishment. He is really walking a fine tightrope that's in between the Republicans and the Democrats, and he's getting heat from both, which probably is a good sign in politics.
I was going to say he's getting heat from both, but he's also a strong favorite for re-election in November, assuming he runs.
He's beyond a strong favorite, and he is running. He has $17 million in the bank so far. There are two Republicans who have said they will run, have announced. Both are pretty well unknown, and they have no money yet.
What's happened to the Republican Party in California?
Well, a lot of people trace it to to Governor Pete Wilson and his efforts to pass an anti-immigration measure, which did pass, in fact, in 1994. He supported this measure, which would cut off all services to illegal immigrants in the state of California. He supported it at a crucial time, and it did, in fact, pass. But Republicans you talk to say that much of their problems has happened after that election, that the feeling among the Latinos, especially in California, which is a major, pretty major force, has been all pro-Democrat and anti-Republican. And Republicans in this state, over the last couple of decades, simply moved very far to the right and out of the mainstream. And California, which used to be reliably red, is now reliably blue.
For all the good polling numbers that Governor Brown has seen, there's still many problems in the state. There are teacher pensions, it's the drought, of course, and wildfires. The work is obviously not done.
That is correct. We have unfunded liabilities looking forward and well in excess of $300 billion, the teachers' pension fund, for example, and other pension funds. And so there are some problems. And the governor does have a few issues that could be tricky politically. He is sort of staking his reputation on building two major infrastructure projects, which is actually very interesting because during his first 8 years as governor, he shied away from building anything, almost like he was rebelling against the legacy of his father, Pat Brown, who helped build the University of California system and the California Aqueduct and the transportation system. But now he wants to build a high-speed rail system that would start in San Francisco, go down to Los Angeles through part of the Central Valley, and eventually to San Diego. The price tag on that is $68 billion. And there are lots of questions as to where that money is going to come from. And the public opinion has soured on that high-speed rail project after it was approved narrowly by the voters a few years ago. And the other project is what's called the Twin Tunnels Project, which would tunnel with gigantic tunnels under the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta and carry water from Northern California to Southern California and to the farms down the valley. And that price tag is $25 billion, and that's just to build it. Ongoing interest, probably over 30 years, would add another $30 billion to that. And that is very, very controversial. So there are some potential pitfalls down the road. But again, as I said earlier, his experience seems to show he's a moderating influence on the Democrats, and he is doing some things that Republicans like.
You've watched Jerry Brown for many, many years. Did you ever see him as this iconic figure in California?
Not the first time. He was elected in 1974, and he had a fairly weak relationship with the state legislature at that time. And as a matter of fact, one of his signature vetoes was of the death penalty, capital punishment, and they overrode that veto. He seemed distracted during the 70s, and he was distracted. He was running for president in 1976 and 1980. He only got a single delegate from the state of Wisconsin in 1980, but at times he seemed disinterested in running California, and critics suggested that he had the attention span of a gnat. These days, though, he doesn't have Potomac fever, and he seems to be paying closer attention to California and its problems.
Steve Swann is a political strategist and analyst in Sacramento. He can be found on Twitter at SteveSwatt09. Thanks a lot, Steve.
You're welcome.
That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible by the generous folks at WAMU 88.5 here in Washington and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. To sign up for our weekly newsletter and to check out bonus junkie content, bad jokes, and scuttlebutt puzzles, you can visit us on the web at kenrudinpolitics.com. Don't forget to send your comments, questions, and cash to ken@kenrudinpolitics.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Ken Rudin and on Facebook. Our producer is A.D. Quigg. Our engineer is Douglas Bell. Our associate producer is Kristen Sorensen. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Thanks for listening. See you next week.